This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hi there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
Iran nuclear negotiations are underway, and if you want to know how big of a farce this is, the United Nations revealed this week that Iran just started enrichment that blatantly violates the terms of the existing nuclear deal. To learn about this, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, since Monday, Iran has been sitting down at the table with, I think it's four other major powers, or five powers, and the United States hasn't been in the room. They've been in the room next door, and there have been discussions that have been faring between the two. To show how much Iran is willing to do to get sanction relief, get money from basically the United States and unfrozen and access to international markets and the unfrozen assets going back to them. And so while this process was playing out on Wednesday, there was an interesting news report that came across that the IAEA reported, which is, again, the nuclear watchdog for the UN agency, or the agency that watches Iran's nuclear program and other nuclear programs around the world. And they reported that Iran started enriching uranium at Fordow up to 20% purity using a cluster of very highly advanced centrifuges. And we could get caught up in all the terminology here, but basically it's like at Fordow, which is an underground bunker site where it's almost impossible, I think, for Israelis to attack it from the sky unless the United States gave them some bunker busters. Israel cannot destroy this facility unless there's some subversive activity. They can't destroy it from the sky. And so Iran has been, which is contrary to the nuclear agreement already, been enriching uranium in this site, but using really slow centrifuges. Basically, they're ticking away and it's going up but not doing much. We've been reporting on how that Iran has installed highly sophisticated centrifuges that cut down on the time to enrich uranium in this location. We've reported on that about, I think, 3 or 4 months ago. And now, right during the nuclear negotiations, they decide to arc them up, start them spinning, and start producing highly enriched uranium, or enriching uranium up to 20%. Now, this was obviously a plan by Iran. People are saying that they did it to try and blackmail the West into falling back. Look what we can do if we want to. So give us what we want, a nuclear demand as such. Or perhaps they just wanted to produce enriched uranium as well. And this was just their time frame for doing it. But again, what a slap in the face for the nuclear negotiations to have Iran step up its nuclear activity during the very negotiations to get them to cut it out.
Now, you wrote about this in the Trumpet brief that went out yesterday, and the eye-popping fact that jumped out there in the headline, Iran is 3 weeks away from nuclear breakout. You mentioned it in the article. There wasn't a specific citation of where that came from, but you're talking about once you get this level of enrichment taking place, this is what we understand about the nuclear development process.
Yeah, I can actually add a citation there if I didn't put the link in there. But this is from David Albright, who, again, he runs the Good ISIS, as he calls it. It's basically the international think tank that looks at Iran's nuclear program and gives facts, highly comprehensive reports based on the IAEA reports. There isn't anyone that actually denies that they're 3 weeks away from this, or it would be very rare to find a report. This has been reported New York Times, it's been reported Time Magazine.
And what that means is it's not that Iran is going to get a nuclear weapon in 3 weeks. It means that if they decided to, if they said now is the time, they could do it within 3 weeks. And essentially, this is what underpins this notion that there is probably some blackmail involved here, that Iran is saying, like, look, we're very capable, and if you guys try to hold us back, you're going to fail.
Right. there are different levels of enriched uranium. You need about 80% actually to, that's what the uranium-235 was at with the Hiroshima bomb. But they say these days you got to get up to 90% enriched uranium having that isotope. And right now, Iran has a stockpile of 60%, which is against a nuclear deal, a stockpile of 20%, which is against a nuclear deal. Technically, they're only allowed to have 3.5%. So right now, their stockpile of 60 and 20% means that if they press start, they could get to having 25 kilograms of 90% highly enriched uranium, which is enough for one nuclear weapon, and this would take them 3 weeks. So that's not a long time at all. Now, what's interesting about this, what's happening at Fordo, is they're enriching up to 20%. So they're not thinking about bomb number one with what they just started up in Fordo. They're thinking about getting bomb number two, bomb number three, bomb number four ready to go, because they already have enough 20% and 60% enriched uranium to get to bomb number one. So this is a process that they are continuing to show that we just don't want one nuclear weapon. We want more. And Albright suggests that in the next 6 months, if they wanted to get to nuclear breakout in the next 3 weeks, in the 6 months following, they would have enough nuclear material for five nuclear weapons, which is intense to think about. Of course, Iran also has to get the ability to the ability to distribute or send this nuclear weapon or fire this nuclear weapon on a ballistic missile or another in another form. So that's another thing that they have to counter. But it's very hard to determine whether Iran has that ability. It's an extreme risk to rely on, let's get them to 90%, who cares, because they still don't have the delivery system. Well, we don't know that's the case. It's easier to track Iran's, it's easier to use the metric of how much nuclear fuel, highly enriched uranium do they have for a nuclear weapon, rather than the other things that they need, because they can buy them from elsewhere. They can buy them from North Korea. They could buy that from China. But do they have a nuclear weapons grade uranium stockpile to use? And that's what they're 3 weeks away from, should they choose to push forward with their plans.
Now, it probably goes without saying, but what Iran is doing here blatantly puts to lie the notion that they've promoted that this is purely for energy purposes. This is absolutely for nuclear weapons and nothing else. You, in your trumpet brief, quoted General Kenneth McKenzie, where he was talking about why this isn't as big of a concern as you might think. The fact that they might get enriched uranium that would be bomb grade isn't necessarily a catastrophe. Maybe you could just talk about America's response to this.
Yeah, it's absolutely shocking, because for the past 30 or 40 years, whenever we've been judging somebody's nuclear whether they're nuclear power or not, or what they're trying to do, we've always used the metric of how much highly enriched uranium do they have. The United States, with some of their comments now through McKenzie and through other reporting of very favorable or left-wing media sources, kind of indicate that that is not the metric that is important anymore. It's like they're already agreeing that they are going to get there to 90%, and instead we are going to focus on the fact that they don't have, or focus on the idea that they don't have a way to send that nuclear weapon or that nuclear, let's say, convert that nuclear material into a bomb and send it somewhere. Yet this is a very big risk, and even David Albright talked about how much of a risk this is. And I quoted from him in the trumpet brief. I'll just quote. He said here, breakout estimates do not include the additional time that Iran would need to convert weapons-grade uranium into weapons components and manufacture a nuclear weapon. This extra time could be substantial, particularly if Iran wanted to build a reliable warhead for ballistic missile. However, these preparations would most likely be conducted at secret sites and would be difficult to detect. Many relevant activities may have been ongoing for years. If Iran successfully produced enough weapons-grade uranium for a nuclear weapon, the ensuing weaponization process might not be detectable until Iran tested its nuclear device underground or otherwise. And so he's basically saying that what the United States is policy now is very risky, downright dangerous, because we can't detect how far along Iran is in the weaponization process. And the next thing we could know is that Iran conducts a nuclear weapons test.
Yeah, the level of naivete and just silly thinking on the part of American leaders that haven't taken this threat seriously enough. It's highlighted, you underscore, just holding this up against their response to this Omicron COVID variant that has come, and just how they're treating that like it's a you know, existential threat to humanity, while they're allowing this to go on. Really a effective tool that you use in that article that you wrote. I would encourage all of our listeners to read that trumpet brief from Brent Noctegal. If you haven't done so, forget Omicron. Iran is 3 weeks away from nuclear breakout. You can find that at thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much, Brent. The appearance of a new COVID variant has governments worldwide slapping down strict new edicts. This is particularly draconian in Europe, part of its broader war on this virus. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, we've had a series of eye-catching responses in Europe to to COVID and enforcing the COVID vaccine, most notably within Germany. Just over the last couple of days, Germany has announced new measures where they're essentially locking down the unvaccinated. They're barring the unvaccinated from being able to go to non-essentials, to be able to go to entertainment venues, even potentially non-essential shops, this kind of thing. And this mandate doesn't let people that are unvaccinated test out of it. You may have a negative test, you are still barred. And they're talking potentially about going even further. Like we've mentioned on this show before, Austria, they've made it illegal to be unvaccinated, and that you're going to be subject to some kind of fine if you refuse to get the vaccine. And Germany's saying, well, they might do the same thing. For Austria, it goes into force in February. Germany's saying, well, we might do the same thing. Germany's Chancellor Olaf Scholz has opened the door for that. So has German Chancellor Angela Merkel. We've seen Greece follow Austria down this same path this week, where they put out an announcement where if you are over 60 and you don't get vaccinated, you'll be fined 100 euros a month. I think that's around $115.
Wow.
So a pretty heavy penalty. And again, it just keeps going every month. You have to continually pay that fine unless you get vaccinated. And to the the European Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, she wants to roll this out for the entire European Union. She said the whole EU should think about mandatory vaccination. So it was only a few weeks ago where this was a pretty extreme and shocking thing. And it may well could be normal just within the next few days or weeks where they're putting it forwards. And the newspapers are all kind of in favor of this in Germany. You know, they're talking about how, well, this is normal. This doesn't mean we're going to be holding people down and physically injecting them. It's fine giving people fines for not getting vaccinated. So you've had this push against the unvaccinated. And then I think the other significant development you've seen this week is this kind of militarized response where the incoming German government that will be taking office probably next week have chosen a general, Major General Carsten Brewer of the German Armed Forces, who will be overseeing Germany's COVID response. And I thought German foreign policy did a good job of talking about the importance of this. They wrote a general with experience from operations in Kosovo and Afghanistan and from the preparation of the Defender Europe major maneuvers will lead the coronavirus crisis team of the incoming government. Since last year, this general, as commander of the Territorial Task Command, has organized the Bundeswehr's administrative assistance in the fight against the COVID-19 pandemic. And they wrote, by assigning posts to a general, the new government, in which the Greens have a strong position, is pushing the normalization of the military forward in society. And that is a good point. There are very strict rules in Germany about what the military can do within Germany, what the military can do in peacetime, what the military can do in society. And so we've seen all kinds of taboos broken in terms of what the government can force you to do when it comes to COVID. And now we're seeing taboos and things broken in terms of what the German military can do within Germany as well.
Yeah, you know, we've been talking quite a lot following the movements of the German military and how these taboos have been falling in terms of, putting soldiers in foreign deployments and so on. And the fact that this is taking place within German society, that the government is comfortable enough using German soldiers in operations against a segment of its own citizenry, which is precisely what happened in World War II that was just so horrifying that led to the Holocaust. And it's impossible not to look at this happening within Germany and not make those kinds of associations.
Yeah, it's and yet everything that's been happening with the German military has been this proverbial step-by-step kind of frog in boiling water situation where, okay, well, first there's the strict rules against Germany's military getting involved. Well, then it's, okay, we'll change the rules so Germany's military can get involved if there's a crisis, if there's a massive flood. And that sounds pretty reasonable. They can come in and they can help flood victims and things like that. And now we're seeing this extended a few steps further. But this is where we're starting to get into, like you say, some extreme and worrying territory. And nobody seems all that concerned about it because it's not too big of a step from where we've come before. So, yeah, it's, I mean, we have an article, Lurch Towards Tyranny, that that I wrote for the last Trumpet print edition, just talking about how the COVID response is conditioning Europe to accept all kinds of things that they wouldn't otherwise accept. And it's just so interesting just in the last week to see several more examples of that. And now, yeah, if you've got talk, I mean, you mentioned those comparisons to World War II when you see what Australia is doing, locking people in voluntary camps. I mean, that seems right out of, maybe the fact that they're calling them voluntary sounds a little more Soviet than Nazi. But still, that seems kind of right out of the World War II era. It's Austria, of all places, the birthplace of Hitler, that brings in mandatory vaccinations for the first time in the Western world. You're right. It is very hard not to reach for these kind of comparisons.
Well, talk about what we expect to see prophetically within Germany. The fact that the government is becoming more authoritarian is right in line with these prophecies, and the fact that it is taking measures that are against specific contingents within its own citizens, that's also something that is prophetically significant.
Right. In our July 2020 issue, fairly well, we're still only just getting started really with COVID. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury had an article, Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire. And in that article, he gave an overview of what the Bible says about what is coming to Europe. And in he brought out several different aspects of this prophecy, that the Bible talks about there being a strong leader in Europe. Revelation 17 talks about it being ruled by kings. Daniel chapter 8 and Daniel chapter 11 have prophecies of a strong leader. There are prophecies of Europe being a massive trading empire, having economic dominance over the whole world. And he talked about those prophecies. And so he went and it talks about the Europe coming together, 10 nations unifying, giving their power to one man. So he covered all of these different strands and showed how the coronavirus was pushing all of these forwards. And I think one of the most dramatic of those strands is this push towards a much more tyrannical style of leadership, a Europe led by kings and a Europe led by a strong man. And one of the statements that really jumps out from that article is he said the people of Europe are being conditioned to accept more tyrannical leadership. And again, that was in July 2020. And that is exactly what we've seen. And I think in response to some of these things, yeah, Italy with their mandatory vaccines, they've been having protests every week. There have been big protests in Austria. But at the same time, in some ways, the surprising thing is that these protests aren't bigger. That the governments do kind of feel that they can get away with doing this and not be toppled. Whereas you would have thought any government in a democratic society would fear to do this to its own people. So you're seeing exactly this. Most people, many people in these countries don't care enough to oppose it. They've been conditioned to tyranny. And, well, who knows where this vaccine's or where this whole coronavirus subject and this vaccine's going to go from here. It could disappear tomorrow. But that conditioning to tyranny is still going to remain. They will have been fine with these kind of extreme measures, and the implication is they would be fine with them again, and everybody knows that now.
Well, we do appreciate that, Richard. We will link to an article that we have up on the website from Josue Michels, Germany to Fight Virus with Vaccine Mandates, Mass Surveillance, Army and Generals, and also Richard's article from the most recent Trumpet print edition, Lurch Toward Tyranny, in the show notes for today's program. Tensions over Ukraine have been building in recent weeks, And revelations over the past couple of weeks intensified those significantly. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the latest here is that Ukrainian officials are reporting that they've discovered a plot to overthrow the Ukrainian government. So this was first announced last Friday. At that time, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said some individuals had been caught on tape discussing Ukraine's richest businessman and how they were planning to persuade this man to back a coup against Zelensky's government. So Zelensky is quite pro-Western, pro-Europe. He's in favor of joining NATO. He's decidedly anti-Russian. So the plan was to remove him and install someone who was anti-West, anti-NATO, and pro-Russia. Now, when Zelensky announced this last Friday, he said this plan did involve individuals from Russia, but he stopped short of saying whether or not the Kremlin or the Russian government was behind it. But then on Tuesday, Ukraine's prime minister followed up and said the evidence does show that these were not just rogue Russians trying to hatch this plan on their own. He said there is proof that the Kremlin was absolutely behind the plan. Russia, of course, denies the allegations, says it's all, you know, made up. But the old adage tells us to never believe anything until the Kremlin denies it. And this plot is being taken very seriously. U.S. officials are working with the Ukrainians right now to examine the evidence. And then there's a group of NATO officials who will be meeting with the Ukrainian government in Latvia about this next week. So there's still quite a bit that we don't know. But we know that Russia has been reaching new levels of just antagonism and belligerence in recent months, especially in its behavior toward Europe. So this would fit right into that pattern. And it's just a very serious and a very worrying situation.
Well, put all of this in context for us, what Russia has been up to in Ukraine. And really, there have been other areas where it's been provoking Europe the way that you just mentioned.
Yes. Yeah, you're exactly right. It's just a new level of antagonism, I think, from Vladimir Putin's Russia, just really across the board lately. We see this in Belarus, where Putin helped the dictator Alexander Lukashenko to stay in power last year after Lukashenko had rigged an election. And now Putin has turned Belarus into a puppet state, and he's flying huge numbers of people from the Middle East into Belarus and then pushing them across the border into EU countries illegally. So this is just a full-blown migrant crisis that Putin has created there. Putin is also apparently backing Serbs in Bosnia, who are threatening to break off from the rest of the country. So just a recipe for serious chaos there. Then there's the energy crisis that we've spoken about on several recent episodes. Russia has throttled supplies of gas into Europe, sending prices through the roof for many Europeans. And there was also the satellite that Russia blew up with a missile last month. That was just an incredibly provocative test, confirming that Russia has the capability to take out the U.S. and Europe's some of their most important space-based assets. And then besides delivering that message, of course, the test also filled one section of low Earth orbit with thousands of pieces of debris, which just, you know, complicates all kinds of space activity. And then, of course, you have the buildup of troops near Ukraine. Reports say that Russia now has somewhere between 92 and 125,000 troops massed around Ukraine's borders, and many believe that an attack is imminent, probably in January or February. So just a whole range of areas where Putin is engaged in provocative behavior, especially toward Europe. And now it looks like we can also add this coup attempt in Ukraine to the list. So just a very provocative direction that Putin is taking.
Well, these revelations about this plotted coup certainly add weight to just what we've been seeing with the buildup of troops in Ukraine and so on. And you just wonder how European leaders are going to react to this. They're in a kind of precarious position relative to Putin right now with what he has over them in terms of energy. The energy weapon and the way that he's using that, and it seems like they kind of have to tread lightly, but it really does underscore their vulnerability to this man and to Russia.
I think that's exactly right. And I believe this has got to be rattling a lot of cages there in Europe. And that's a detail that Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has been calling attention to for a number of years, because he says that it is leading to the fulfillment of certain Bible prophecies about Europe uniting. Back in 2004, Putin's dictatorial colors, you could say, were really beginning to show after he had rigged an election. And at that time, Mr. Fleury said that kind of Russian activity would scare the Europeans into close unification. He wrote, quote, "Mr. Putin has just changed the course of world history, and Bible prophecy reveals exactly where it is leading. The Russian election is triggering a fear that will hasten the uniting of the European Union. It will cause Germany and other European nations to want a strong leader. Throughout history, Germany has often sought a stronger leader. Bible prophecy says it will do so again for the last time." End quote. And Mr. Fleury points to Daniel 11:44 to show that fear of Russia will be a big part of what prompts the Europeans to lay aside their differences and unite, and just to kind of get their own Putin so that they can challenge, you know, the actual Putin there in Russia. And I think if you look at Russia right now, the coup plans, the migrant crisis, the buildup of forces and everything else, it's easy to see how this would all be just extremely alarming to the people of Europe, and how they would see that they need to unify in order to confront it.
Well, we do have an article coming up at thetrumpet.com by our writer Rufaro Manyepa on this coup attempt, and we'll direct you to that in the show notes for today's program. We also have an article from Gerald Fleury from some years ago that Jeremiah referenced, "Russia Frightens Europe and Fulfills Bible Prophecy." So go check that out to learn more about the prophetic significance of what's happening there in Ukraine. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. A horrifying school shooting incident this week has the nation again rattled, and looking at the problems that cause these kinds of horrific tragedies. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this particular horrific tragedy occurred in at Oxford High School in Michigan, when Ethan Crumley, who's a 15-year-old, walked into school about noon with a pistol he'd stolen from his father, and shot four students to death, injured seven more, and injured a teacher as well. And so it is just really sobering to reflect on how commonly these things are happening in America today. I remember still back in 1999 when the Columbine shooting happened, and how shocked I was at that, and how shocked the nation was at that. And we even had a feature article in the Philadelphia Trumpet about it at the time, because it seemed like, just from my recollection, that it almost seemed like an unprecedented thing. But now, like I said, you do have these shootings happen so many times a year in America that it's almost easy to kind of become numb to them. I saw this story and then debated a little bit whether I wanted to talk about this particular story on Trumpet Hour today, or to look for some of the other big news that's happening in America, and then decided, like, no, I think this is pretty important to talk about the story.
But the fact that it was a question, just, it shows you just how routine these types of things have become.
Right. Yeah. It is sadly how routine these types of things have become. And of course, every time they happen, and it happened this time as well, the Democrats rushed to try to double down on the need for more gun control in America, even though, like I said, in this particular case, it was a teenage boy who stole his dad's pistol. There's really no gun law under consideration that would prevent that type of thing from happening. It wasn't an assault rifle or a semi-automatic weapon or some weapon of war that was stolen. It was just a common pistol that a teenage boy took from his father. But in the investigation, they've definitely uncovered quite a few disturbing details about this particular teenage boy's life. They've already scrubbed most of his social media accounts, but they've definitely found a couple videos on his phone from the night before about him talking about shooting people in his school. They'd found journal entries that he had in his journal about him talking about shooting people in his school. He was known to have been a pretty pretty avid player of the Call of Duty video game, which is a video game where you go through simulations where you're shooting people in the virtual world. It also looks like he definitely had some behavioral problems at the school before, where his parents had been called in that morning before the shooting happened to talk to teachers about some of these behavioral problems. And even though it does look like he had both parents in the home, his father had gotten in some trouble for child support payments that he wasn't paying to another family he had previously in Florida. So it definitely looks like there were some serious family problems at the home that were contributing to these behavioral problems, at least letting their son play violent video games and have access to a gun at the very least. Enough that it looks like the prosecutors, they're going to charge Ethan Crumley as an adult since the crime was premeditated instead of as a juvenile. And it looks like they may charge his parents with some crime as well, just due to their negligence and letting him have access to the weapon that he used to commit this attack.
So a lot of people, every time this happens, they try to discuss causes, and in virtually every case, it's just so clear. There's so many signs that led up to this tragic event. Obviously, there are kids out there that are doing similar type things that don't actually get a gun and kill people, but those who do get a gun and kill people are always caught up in the video games. They are, you know, demonstrating lots of antisocial behavior. They're giving off all kinds of warning signs that people ignore. What do you see as being the takeaway from what happened this week?
Right. Well, the big takeaway, and the article we'll put in the show notes, is an article that we've actually made a reprint article for our Key of David reprint series now called Why Kids Kill, What is God's Answer? And that reprint article is from the May 1999 Philadelphia Trumpet by Mr. Stephen Fleury that we wrote in the aftermath of the Columbine shooting. And so the root causes stay the same, where in this section of the article on the solution, he even mentions, he's like, I could talk quite a bit about how different the world will be when Christ returns. But he's like, in the world today, the root cause of these type of things is family breakdown. Like I said, these are always students, usually with a bad relationship with their father, almost always with either an addiction to medication or a violent video game habit, severe like antisocial behavior. And the whole second half of this article on why kids kill is actually a history lesson from the lesson of the life of George Washington, where pretty famously, like, George Washington's mother was asked how she raised such an amazing son, and she replied that I taught him to obey. And then George's father, Augustus Washington, had said that he taught him to obey cheerfully. And then it goes through quite a bit about George Washington's upbringing, his with his parents, and also with the school he attended, where he actually attended a private school growing up that taught the students to obey the Ten Commandments. The talk to students things like don't speak evil of the absent, always speak of God with reverence, let your recreations be manful, not sinful, do not correct another in anger, let your conversation be without malice and envy, and other things that, like I said, if you start with the student there, where you're talking about the Ten Commandments and how to obey cheerfully and how to not gossip and how to not correct another in anger and all these other things, it's like, even if they're struggling with some of those things, they never get to the point where you have to explain to them, don't steal your dad's pistol and kill 12 people.
Absolutely. So Why Kids Kill is the name of the article that we'll link to in the show notes from Stephen Fleury, pointing to that family breakdown and some of those root causes for these problems that we see taking place with increasing frequency in America today. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, China drawing African nations into its neocolonial orbit, and at least one case with the help of President Joe Biden's own son. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We spoke on Wednesday's Trumpet Hour about Barbados opening the door for Chinese imperialism. Our next story shows how this same tale is playing out within Uganda. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, just to give a little bit of context to this development, it was about 8 years ago now that Chinese President Xi Jinping announced his goal of rebuilding the ancient Silk Road. That was the network of trade routes in ancient times that just facilitated the movement of goods and ideas across Asia and Europe especially. And so Xi Jinping said he had determined to make a new and improved version of it that would basically build roads and railways and ports and much more in dozens of nations, including African nations, all just to better connect the rest of the world to China. And Uganda was one of the first African countries to sign up. They accepted a loan from China for more than $200 million to expand the famous Entebbe Airport. That's the airport where the big terrorist crisis happened there in the 70s, where the hostages were held until Israeli commandos waged their, you know, legendary raid to free them. But this is also Uganda's only international airport, so it's just a vital national asset. And the Ugandans thought that by accepting this money from China, they could improve and expand the airport and that it would strengthen their economy. But just as we've seen with several other nations who signed on to China's Belt and Road, the Ugandans apparently were a little bit naive about some of the loan's terms, including the exorbitant interest rates and the fact that the arrangement waived off a clause for international immunity. And it actually attached Entebbe Airport to the loan as a kind of collateral. So now it's been about 6 years since Uganda took this loan, and the nation is really struggling to repay it. And so China is in a position to take over the possession of Entebbe International Airport. And many Ugandans are now sounding the alarm, saying that they've fallen into China's debt trap, and now they're about to lose this, you know, this national asset. So just a major loss for Uganda if that happens, and a major win for China.
It really is a warning to anyone that puts themselves in a position to do this kind of level of business with China. And maybe you could just talk about China's overall activity within Africa, just how deeply entrenched in that continent has become.
Yes, well, there's a whole handful of nations that have signed on to the Belt and Road, and several of them are in a similarly precarious situation now, with assets that they're in a position where they may need to forfeit those now to China. Kenya, for example, is at risk of having to give China control of their main port and also control of one of their major railway lines. And then there's also Djibouti and Zambia. So these countries are all in serious trouble, thanks largely to just kind of a lack of transparency in China's Belt and Road loans. And now we can add Uganda to that list as well.
When we spoke about Barbados turning its back on the British Empire and kind of spurning the rule by Britain's queen, we were just talking on the program on Wednesday about how it's ironic that it is now turning to China. China's putting the same kind of investment, level of investment, in Barbados and other Caribbean nations. But this really is the way I see it, is you look at the decline of the British royal family and the rise of China, and it's kind of like the times of the Gentiles in miniature.
I think that's exactly right. Yeah, that's a Bible prophecy recorded in Luke chapter 21 about the times of the Gentiles. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury wrote an article all about that prophecy in our July 2014 issue. It's called What Are the Times of the Gentiles? He explains in there that Gentile in this context basically means not America and not Britain. And, you know, for many decades, America and British supremacy did bring stability to much of the world, to some of those Caribbean nations that you mentioned, and also to Uganda, which was under the British for many years. And so was Sri Lanka and a few of the other nations that have fallen into China's debt trap. So under the supremacy of Britain and America, those countries and many others really were stabilized and advanced in some major ways, despite the fact that, of course, the leadership from those countries was imperfect. It was still ultimately a stabilizing force. But in this new era, called the times of the Gentiles, the main global powers will instead be countries like China and Russia, and also Germany. So right now we can see that China's expansion of the Belt and Road into countries like Uganda, and as you mentioned, what's happening there in Barbados, we can see that this is shifting global power away from the US and the UK and toward these other nations like China and Russia. And the fact that the Belt and Road is just strong-arming so many of these countries into giving China incredible power over their countries, that makes, I think that makes the dangers of this shift into the times of the Gentiles more plain.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. China's activities in Africa are extensive, and its grip on crucial resources continues to grow, giving it increasing leverage over a lot of modern manufacturing. Well, shamefully, it's gotten some help in these efforts from one disgraceful source. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, we talked a bit in the first half of the show about the problems delinquent children are posing to America. So I figured it was only appropriate to head in here in the second half with a story about America's most famous delinquent son, Hunter Biden. Now, Hunter Biden, he's been caught in a numerous cash scandals, selling American natural resources to countries like Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Russia, and China. But the most recent one is a report from the New York Times this week about how Hunter Biden, in his role at Bohai Harvest RST, actually helped sell the world's largest cobalt mine to the Chinese. Now, this mine is located in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Actually, most of the world's cobalt is located in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. There are a few good mines in Canada and Australia, but about 67% of the world's cobalt production is in this one African nation. And so this is a big deal that Hunter Biden helped the Chinese purchase this, because America and China are kind of in like a great game, or this geopolitical rivalry over cobalt resources. Cobalt's something you probably don't think about much, but it's pretty much used in all advanced electronics, your car, your iPhone, all this radio recording equipment that's around me in the studio right now. You need cobalt to manufacture it. And so we're pretty reliant on the Democratic Republic of the Congo for that resource. China's trying to buy up the mines so that they control the world's supply. And even Joe Biden himself has admitted that this is a bit of a problem, because he's pushing hard for all these electric cars that have batteries that just take pounds of cobalt. Mm. And so he's saying that there's really no way for us to manufacture the electric cars he wants without a cobalt supply. And so I guess that means that the U.S. will just have to buy more of those from China. And so it does just kind of pretty much undisputable fact that these must be crocodile tears that Joe Biden's shedding as he's talking about the challenges America faces securing its cobalt supply, while his son is working to sell off the cobalt chines to Mina to China. They do a lot of mining in China for profit.
Mm-hmm. So you not only do you have the issue of just how dependent the United States has become on these foreign sources and how careless it has been to secure them. China obviously sees where these technologies just getting a hold of the sources of these resources that it has, securing those to make sure that it's positioning itself for long-term profitability and being able to get even monopolistic control over some of these resources, just much further ahead thinking on China's part than the United States. But that you have someone who is in such a high placed position, who's actually leveraged the advantages that he has because of his father's political career to sell these types of resources that are so contrary to American national interests. It's shameful. It's hypocritical. It's shocking. It's really appalling.
Yeah, that's absolutely. And we're going to put in the show notes The United States and Britain in Prophecy, because that book doesn't really mention much about cobalt, because that's one of the minerals that no one in the world really cared about until fairly recently when the electronics got more advanced. But it does have a ton of statistics I've been working for the past half a week or so to try to update on a lot of the other natural wealth that God blessed the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh with: gold and iron and steel and aluminum and bauxite and tin and zinc and nickel and other things that 100 years ago America and Britain together controlled. Like, it varies mineral by mineral, but close to like 2/3 of the world's total production. And now it's down to, I don't know, less than a third. And the nation's getting worried that if some of the nations that do control that production, like China, aren't willing to sell, we could be in a pretty place where we just don't have the raw materials to keep our military functioning.
Yeah, and it just makes it that much more difficult to stomach when you see how much of that is because of bad behavior on the part of individuals, like you're talking about. There are a lot of factors that went into this. God has been cursing the United States for its sins and the stripping of its ability to produce these resources. Its access to these resources is part of that, but it's also self-inflicted in a lot of cases. Well, Andrew, just kind of let the cat out of the bag a little bit about the coming print edition of The Trumpet. We're planning a special issue for our anniversary issue, the February issue of The Trumpet, that goes into some of the detail about the United States and Britain in prophecy, and just how you see the fall of these modern nations of Israel taking place on a dramatic scale today. And what he's working on is for the infographic that will update some of those eye-popping statistics that Mr. Armstrong brought out in that book that really are even all the more dramatic based on what's happened in the years since he wrote that book. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. Another setback in relations between the new Israeli government and the United States this week. For this, we'll go back to Brent Nachtigall.
Israel and the United States have often really had arguments over Israel's building of new houses or approving new houses to be constructed in the territory of Judea and Samaria and East Jerusalem, or what's known as the West Bank. And this is has come up with every Israeli government. And up to this point, the current Israeli government, led by Naftali Bennett, hasn't really pressed ahead with too much construction at all, as to not offend the Biden administration. The Biden administration, when it came in, talked about how settlement construction, as they call it, or any building out on the other side of the Green Line, that needs to not necessarily be halted, but extremely discouraged. And this week, we had a bit of a dust-up between Secretary of State Blinken and Naftali Bennett. This is where Israel had put forward a plan to construct 9,000 new homes in Atarot, which is just north of Jerusalem, between Jerusalem and Ramallah. This is an area that used to be Jerusalem's airport, and they were going to approve the construction of these 9,000-person homes, or 9,000 homes. And then the United States decided that they didn't like that, and so there was a call that said, we can't talk, we can't do this, don't go forward with it. And so then we had Bennett deciding to cancel it, but then it somehow appeared on Monday morning's meeting that it was going to go ahead in planning. And so Secretary of State Blinken initiated a phone call just yesterday with Naftali Bennett to express basically outrage, a call that was described as very intense, saying that this was not something that was definitely not what the Biden administration wanted, and that they needed to halt all construction here or approval, the approval process for construction here in Atarot, just north of Jerusalem.
So what do you make of it? Put this in the context of the relationship between the United States and Israel more broadly.
So obviously, this government that's coming in, well, the Biden administration is championing the two-state solution still, kind of this failed framework for the peace process over the past 30 years. You'd have a Palestinian state and Israeli state. And so any type of construction that would exist inside what they believe is a future Palestinian state shows that Israel is not serious about ever moving forward with peace. Now, Israel... if you live in Jerusalem, you know that they're running out of spots to build. And so everywhere that's open is basically in East Jerusalem. And so it's kind of like this decision that Israel is making to allow for both natural growth in East Jerusalem and the West Bank among Israelis that live there and Jews that live there, as well as some new constructions. And the Biden administration is coming down very hard. I wanted to bring up this story because it just shows how much the United States really puts pressure on the Israeli government with its independent policy decisions, construction decisions. Who else does the United States government call up and say, no, you can't build 9,000 homes in this location? It's putting Israel and the United States in this relationship under extreme pressure, more than just the Iran nuclear deal that you talked about in the first segment. Even when it comes to building houses, there is disagreements. Now, the Bible talks about that there is going to be a breaking of the relationship between the United States and Israel, and we're just seeing this on display all the time. And who would have guessed it would be this government? Both are left-wing governments. Both governments are ideologically very similar in many ways, and yet they can't even agree on the way forward. And so this prophecy is becoming more and more clear before us. Something that people can read to look at this prophecy in more detail where it's found in the Bible is an article entitled Breaking the Brotherhood.
Yeah. Do you find take a little bit of solace in the fact that the Israeli government was willing to risk alienating the Biden administration in order to do this? It seems like this is a government that we haven't expected great things from, but it seems like at least they're showing a little bit of independence and a little bit of spine in this situation.
Right. Well, you do have some right-wing elements inside this government. Remember, this government isn't anyone but Bibi, anyone but Netanyahu government. So you've got the right-wing elements that want construction here in this area. And you've got the left-wing elements. Actually, some of them want to, but the Arab parties obviously don't. And so if this government is not going to break apart, you're going to have to do some things that to make your right-wing constituency happy. And so that's what I think we're seeing with this move.
Yeah. Breaking the Brotherhood is the article we'll link to in the show notes for the program today. Thanks very much for that, Brent. One final story. A troubling move in the Balkan nation of Croatia brings back some horrifying World War II history. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, I found this news story pretty shocking, where Croatia is creating a new memorial for war victims in the heart of its capital city. And basically this, what they're doing would be as bad, if not worse, than Germany setting up a war memorial for the SS in the middle of Berlin. That is not at all an exaggeration of what Croatia is doing here. So their Parliamentary Committee for War Veterans Affairs supported a proposal on November 23rd to create this new graveyard in this cemetery. And this is a very central cemetery. It's not just some out of the way place. It was built as a kind of palatial summer residence for a 19th century Croatian politician. Then it was eventually kind of moved into being a cemetery and a park right at the middle of the town. And they're putting them right in the middle of their capital. And we need to remember who we're talking about. This is a cemetery for Croatia's Ustashi soldiers. These were soldiers whose cruelty was so extreme that it shocked even the Nazis. They massacred the numbers vary wildly, but potentially a million people. Conservative estimates put that at around 500,000 Serbs, and then 200,000 Croats, 90,000 Bosnian Muslims, 60,000 Jews. They established a death camp for killing many of these people. So it wasn't just people killed in battle at all. This was rounding people up for systematic execution and even torture. And so these people, they're now memorializing right in the center of their capital.
Now, this just brings to mind statements that Gerald Fleury made in that Germany's Conquest of the Balkans booklet he wrote some time ago. He was talking, this was when Tudjman was still president of Croatia, and he was talking about this man being a Nazi sympathizer and the fact that there was this kind of sympathy within Croatia for that history was really troubling. And the relationships between Germany and Croatia were both in World War II, and the fact that these were still being nurtured today was really troubling. Maybe you can just fill us in on some of that history and what Gerald Fleury said about this, why it's significant prophetically.
Yeah, I mean, Croatia, when they broke away from Yugoslavia, didn't hide at all any of this harkening back to the fascist era. You know, they made the Ustashi flag a national symbol. They named the Croatian currency after the currency of the fascist era. Tudjman himself was a Holocaust denier. You know, they were very open that what they were doing was a continuation of what Croatia was doing in World War II, and that they were a continuation of the Nazi ally and fascist state in World War II. Now, they also spent a lot of money hiring PR executives in the West, and the media kind of went along with a very deceitful narrative about Croatia and all of Yugoslavia, really. But you mentioned that quote. Mr. Fleury talked about how, well, he said that it's disturbing that Tudjman would not disassociate himself from the Croatian fascists or the Nazis of the 1940s, yet was still a respected leader in a Roman Catholic country. And he said that this whole thing was rather alarming. And he drew attention to the links between Croatia and both Germany and the Catholic Church, that you've got both of these countries not disassociating themselves with this kind of person, except, in fact, doing the opposite. That Germany and the Catholic Church during World War II were the Croatian's biggest supporters. And in this modern state, they were Croatia's biggest supporters, despite all of this disturbing history. And so not only did what happened in Yugoslavia in the 90s and all of the things that Croatia are doing today raise important questions about Croatia, they raise very important questions about Germany and about the Vatican. And so Mr. Fleury really focused on this in the early 90s. We have a book, Germany's Conquest of the Balkans, or a booklet that he wrote that covers that absolutely critical history. Because one of the main prophecies that we watch and that we talk about is the rise of this power in Germany that's going to be led by a church, and it's going to be, you know, a very extreme right-wing country, like we talked about in the first half. And the Bible has a lot of specific prophecies about that. Well, we saw those prophecies in action in Yugoslavia, that they were a forerunner of what is coming. And that's really what Mr. Fleury talks about in that booklet, Germany's Conquest of the Balkans.
Well, very good. We will link to that in the show notes for the program today. Thank you very much for that, Richard. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Albert Einstein. Anyone who's never made a mistake has never tried anything new. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.